This is called dead air. That's what we specialize in here at this station.
Yeah.
Wait, here we go.
Hey, who? What? Get your hands up.
Stand where you are. Don't move.
Don't reach for them guns.
Take it easy, you galoots. Put away the hardware and relax.
It's Greg.
Greetings, my friend. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing to you the full story of what happened on that fateful day. We are giving you all the evidence based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Let us punish the guilty. Let us reward the innocent. My friend, can your heart stand the shocking facts about
Radio Mysterioso.
Hey, it's Radio Mysterioso here for the, I don't even know what today is. It's like the 15th. 15th of February 2015. And as announced on this, the site, we have Mike Marinacci here. Just a second. Let me stop this so we can hear Mike. You still there, Mike?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, excellent. Mike is, if you did not know, which you probably do, Mike was one of the co-authors of Weird California, and beat us all to the punch with the inspirational, wonderful, great book, Mysterious California, published in, what, 1988, was it, Mike?
Yes. Yeah.
And there was stuff that was in that book that I thought was quite interesting that did not end up in Weird California. I don't think that that goat man in of the Billowack Dairy, did that end up in?
I don't think so.
I don't think it did.
I haven't looked at either book in quite a while, but I know what you mean. About half or two thirds of what I wrote about in Mysterious California just didn't make the cut for Weird California. I think they just picked the stuff that they could really have the best visuals for and that also were the most tourist-friendly, and then put those together with what you'd done and what Joe had done,
yeah.
And hence Weird California.
I noticed they took it. I think they probably assigned us all like way more than they were going to use, and then some of it ended up in other books.
Yeah. Just looking out my door at the night silhouette of Mount Tamalpais, and I know that none of the stuff that I wrote about that got in there, about the Phantom Panther of Sir Francis Drake Boulevard or the Curse of Mount Tamalpais or any of those things. So there's just one thing I think off the top of my head that I know kind of got left out.
Is Mount that's like east of East Bay, right? It's not like it's not like Marin
County.
Okay, because I think I went to a birthday party there once in a hotel that you had to hike to. You had to hike like up the mountain to get to the hotel. I mean, I think they can drive.
I forget the name of that place.
Yeah. They, I don't think they had any electricity or something. They had running water, and we had to make all our food in this huge old kitchen. And the place was lit by propane lamps.
Yes. I can't think of the name of that place offhand, but I know what you speak. It's just south of Mill Valley.
Yeah. Yeah, somebody invited me to a birthday party. I think somebody I knew turned 40, and he said, we're going to have a big party at Mount Tam in the hotel there. So, yeah, you had to park down at the bottom of the mountain and hike for like I don't know, at least half an hour, probably an hour, with all your stuff up to the hotel. But we did not see any Phantom Panthers. Hey, the reason I was having Mike on today is he has a new project, or not that new, it's been around for a while. It's a website called Califia's Children. What it is, I'll be totally lazy and read right off his site. An informal survey of the diverse religious groups, sects, and cults that have emerged from or settled in California. And how long have you been doing this? For about 3 months now? There's enough on there for a book
now. Well, the blog has been up since October, but this is a project I've actually been working on for many years, just compiling information about the so-called new religions and sects and cults that have either emerged from or settled in the state of California since around Gold Rush times. I've always been fascinated by comparative religion and by the origin of new and unusual sects. And combining that with my love of California history and culture, I just came up with Califia's Children. Really, the suggestion for the name, I had originally called it California Cults, but that's a little too pejorative. I think the word cult has really gotten some bad associations, particularly in the wake of Jonestown in the late 70s.
And Manson, too.
Yeah, to make it broader and apply more to, I think, more benevolent or neutral groups that happen to be new religions, the word calling it Califia, naming it after Califia, was actually suggested by Joe Carson, who runs an organization called Ferroferia, which was probably the first neo-pagan group that ever existed in the United States. They date back to the late 50s. And their founder, Fred Adams, had all along had this fixation on Califia. She was in the heroine of a novel in, I believe, 16th or 17th century Spain. Califia was a black Amazonian goddess that ran her own island country. And when the Spanish came here, they really thought the place was so otherworldly and so distinct. They said, well, this must be like Califia's land here. It really exists. And so they named it after her. I mean, that would be like us naming a new country Never Never Land or Oz or something. It had those kind of connotations. To me, Califia's Children are the product, really, of that sort of fanciful and inventive and creative thinking in the area of metaphysics and how it's manifested in the formation of these new religions and sects and cults and churches and whatnot.
So what people don't realize is, well, maybe they do realize it, that California has always been a place where people ran away to. And when they ran away to it, all their weirdness came with them, including strange views of what the world was like. I'm surprised that the Mormons didn't make it here. They stopped in Utah because
actually,
there was nobody there.
They
came to San Francisco.
A colony they had a little colony in San Francisco, and they had a bigger one around San Bernardino.
They
had quite a presence there in the 1840s and 1850s, and there was a proposal to some kind of a trail along from Salt Lake City to San Bernardino, and then just put Mormon missions and communities along the whole trail, so they had this whole kind of settlement throughout the Southwest. It didn't quite work out. But no, they had quite a presence here in the mid-19th century.
I was talking to Bill Moore once, and he said that I believe that the Mormons were a group of Mormons were sailing into San Francisco Harbor at one point, and they were going to claim it for the Mormon Church, and they saw the American flag flying at Fort Point, and they all went, "Damn it!" And they turned around and went back. Is there truth to that?
I've never heard that story before. Tell you the truth, but it's a good story. I mean, it's funny, a couple of weeks ago I was at Fort Point, and they had their Civil War days.
Oh, yeah,
they
I saw
have all
your
the
pictures.
Reenactors out there. And
yeah.
You probably saw my pictures from it on Facebook.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't surprise me if that happened, because it seemed like right after the victories in the the Mexican-American War, there was a real attempt to really secure and nail down Yerba Buena, now called San Francisco, so that things like that wouldn't happen, because you had at various times, you've had the English and the Argentinians and the Spanish, of course, and the Mexicans, of course,
Russians.
And I mean, even the Russians.
Yeah, Russian traders are trading. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Because they were hunting otters and other things for for the fur.
Yeah, I've been to Fort Ross, which was their real stronghold up on the Sonoma coast, and it's funny when during the days of the high days of Perestroika, Gorbachev visited the Bay Area. One of the places they took him to was Fort Ross, because it's like a little tiny chunk of old Russia on the California coast that's just been preserved for 160, 170 years.
Yeah, and the Portuguese left wild pigs out on the isle, on the Channel Islands that are still there.
Oh yeah. And so it's a lot of people have tried to claim it, and it was really the Americans who had the last say, but there have been so many weird and fascinating cultural imprints on the place. I mean, you were talking earlier about how this is sort of where people end up when they're just trying to start some kind of a fire in one way or another, and or don't fit in or whatnot. And I always say it's as far as you can go in the Western world, and it's also kind of a jumping off bridge to the Eastern world. And you have all these funny cultural influences coming from Asia and from Latin America and from the rest of the West sort of coagulating here and becoming this new thing.
What is the earliest? I mean, do you have that up on your site yet? The earliest, like what you would call it?
Earliest?
I guess what you would call a cult, besides the Mormons.
Yeah. The first one, and I have them up there, is the Reformed New Testament Church, which was founded by a Scotsman. What was his name? Looking it up here in the going over to the library here. William Mooney. He was a Scottish evangelical preacher who had originally gone to Mexico and had gotten in various controversies with the Catholic padres down there, and then decided the real action was in the Pueblo de los. And he settled there during the Mexican-American War, and actually got caught up a bit in the hostilities there. And after it became American territory, when it was still very much Spanish-speaking and very small, he wrote what is the first book published in English in Los Angeles or perhaps even California, the Reform of the New Testament Church. And based a cult or a sect, or rather a Christian sect, around these evangelical teachings. And he never had more than about a dozen people in it. But then that was actually a pretty good flock back in the days when Los Angeles only had 3,000 people living there. That would be like 12,000.
Yeah,
having a flock of 12,000 now.
Yeah.
And he was just kind of a polymath. He was a self-taught doctor, he was an academic, he was an architect, he had all these, he collected strange things from around the old California territory, most of which disappeared after his death, and was just a frontier eccentric and just a fascinating man. He's buried in the big Episcopal cemetery at in San Gabriel, where there's a big monument to General George Patton, because the Patton family were one of the big benefactors of the cemetery and of the church. So that was the first one, and that was about 1853-54 when that got going, right after the gold rush started, although it was in Los Angeles rather than the Bay Area or the gold country.
Right. I don't know if I'd include. Well, they weren't a cult. It was kind of the subgenius people of their day. Do you know who I'm talking about?
Oh yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would classify this. Well, you tell it.
Yeah. Well, he was just very cantankerous. He loved getting into arguments with other religious leaders, and would just in the pages of the old Los Angeles Star, which was the first real newspaper of early American Los Angeles, he would just be having all these debates with the local Catholic padre and the local Mormon quorum leader. And yeah, there was something a little surreal about the guy. One time he made it a public challenge. He said, "I want to be buried in the earth for 3 years, because 3 days, because I have the faith that I can rise from it like Jesus." And so some people took him up on it. And so they dug a grave, put him in a coffin, and then as soon as they started shoveling earth on it, he started screaming, saying, "Get out, get me out, get me out." And it just became this kind of, he became kind of a laughing stock for a while. You know, you can't last 3 minutes down in the ground, much less 3 days. So he, William Mooney, every now and then he kind of gets rediscovered by a Los Angeles, a Southern California historian, but his story is largely unknown. And it's funny because, again, it was the first historical indigenous sect in California, and probably the first book published in English, and probably the first periodical published in English. He had a periodical with the Christian Century or the Christian Month or something like that, that did one issue and then folded, but technically it was the first magazine in English.
Okay, you're still talking about Mooney. I was talking about Eclampus vitus.
Oh, Eclampus vitus.
Yeah, which I called the first subgenius church, I think, or one of them.
Yeah, they're not a church. They're more of a fraternal organization.
Yeah, exactly.
And, yeah, they combine really good work that they do with preserving historical sites around California and the West and educating people about them, with a lot of very Shriners-esque sort of absurdist partying activities and rituals. I have respect for them. I think they do a lot of good work.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't classify them, obviously, like you said, as a cult, but I don't know why. It's just a hobby horse of mine. I really like them, so... And plus, I don't know about Northern California, but all over Southern California, there's these monuments at obscure places. Like, there's a monument to prostitutes in one of the mining camps, and there's a monument about the single rail railway out at like Trona, and it just nobody would go and visit. There's even a monument at the Integratron for them.
Incredible archives and grasp of the history around here. And you mentioned the Clampers.
Yeah.
One place that they have helped preserve is the old settlement of the Esoteric Fraternity, which was another one of the first groups to really emerge out of California. They were up in the Gold Country and near a little town. What is that town called? Kind of about half an hour's drive up the 80 from Sacramento. And they had some very odd teachings. Officially, they taught this sort of like theosophical view of the universe and were very much into celibacy. But there are rumors that were, and evidence uncovered by a researcher fairly recently, that at least the leader was not really celibate. He may have been using some of it as a little private tantric sex cult, and was just very. He'd kind of gotten busted when he was doing this in Boston. You know, a few years before, he'd gotten busted there doing this and had to leave Boston. So when he was more careful when he came out to California. But yeah, they had a little settlement for many, many years up in the Gold Country. And it's still there, and it's maintained now by Eucalyptus vitus, because the last living member of it, of this little the communal group there, I think died years ago, and so now it's just this funny kind of little monument to this group. And interestingly enough, one person was fascinated by the group, and you're a UFO researcher, so you would like this. Jacques Vallée wrote about the Esoteric Fraternity in his book, Messengers of Deception.
Huh, I don't remember seeing that, but I haven't read the book in a long time. Go ahead.
Jacques Vallée was really tied them into this thesis he had about what we call the Melchizedek order.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And that there was this kind of authoritarian strain that was beginning to come out in New Age spirituality that was linked up with ufology and was linked up with the whole concept of the Melchizedek priesthood, which is mentioned in Genesis in the Bible and is also, I think, mentioned quite a bit in both Catholic and Mormon teachings about that, how both Catholic priests and Mormon elders are the inheritors of the Melchizedek line, that they can trace their authority back to that ancient source.
One of the people on your blog actually started a group called them, said he was the, well, probably more than one of them did it, but said he was one of the spiritual heirs of the Melchizedek order. And that was, what was his name?
Krishnavenda.
Yeah, that's it.
Oh, yeah.
That's a great story. Krishnavenda, and he looks like a guru, even though he was in jail like a bunch of times.
Yeah. Well, there's some real interesting parallels between him and Charles Manson, except he preceded Manson by more than a decade. But both were ex-cons. Both were guys with beards. Both which was weird because Krishnavenda, because he's in the 40s and 50s when this was extremely unfashionable. Both declared themselves messiahs. Both formed these communities, these little kind of low-tech communes up in the hills above the San Fernando Valley. Both were millenarians. They're predicting the end of the world. Both thought that there was going to be a race war between American whites and American blacks, and that their people had to kind of retreat from that into the desert and wait for that to play itself out. And both of them ended up with getting a lot of people killed. Of course, Manson because of Helter Skelter, and Krishnavenda because he had a couple of dissident members who were not happy with the way he was doing things. Said dissident members showed up at this at the Krishnavenda commune one morning in 1958 with a bag full of dynamite and blew themselves and him and seven other people and the whole building up. And it was headline news for quite a while. I mean, it was unprecedented for all the weirdness in California cults. Something like that, there'd just been nothing like that before. And oddly enough, they survived the loss of Krishna and some of their people. They kind of limped along for another 20, 30 years on the site. And Manson actually hung out there for a while when he was in the area, and he sort of often said that he accepted Krishnavenda's mantle after he died, that he thought he was the next one carrying, you know, that there were these parallels between Francis Benkovic, who is Krishnavenda's real name, between that guy's life and Manson's own, that he said he was, you know, kind of taking over for what he was trying to do.
Yeah, well, they were in this, as you bring up, they were in the same area. They were in Santa Susana Pass there.
Yeah. There's this one little area up there, which I just can consider a hot spot of bad cultism. You have, working backwards, you have Manson up there in the late 60s. You have Krishnavenda there from the late 40s to the late 50s. And in the 1920s, you had a group up there called the Eleven, who were into some very strange stuff, animal sacrifice, big animals too, mules. They would use, according to the story, they would dispatch, one night they dispatched this mule ceremonially with a Thompson submachine gun. I mean, just real whack jobs. They did sex magic. They had at least there are two murders attributed to them, but they've never been proven as murders, but it's pretty sure they probably whacked a couple of their dissidents. They were carrying around the corpse of a teenage girl who died for over a year trying to resurrect her. I mean, it was just this gothic horror story that came out of there. And the only reason it didn't become bigger, because when the story finally started breaking,
people couldn't believe it.
1920. I'm sorry?
People couldn't believe it.
Yeah, no. It wasn't because of that.
Okay.
Because it started breaking out in October 1929, and just after it broke.
Oh, yeah. Stock market crash.
Friday.
Yeah.
Everything else off the pages, and it's something that every now and then a researcher finds out about and writes something about. There's been a couple of, there's a fictional book based on it now, but I'm going to be delving into them in the next few weeks and writing about that, because that was a real strange bunch. Was led by a woman named Mayotis Blackburn.
What was the woman's relationship to them? Oh, is that
she
who
was the head of it?
Oh, okay.
She was the head of it. Her second in command was a younger woman. Forget her name. And there's always been suspicion that the two of them get away with this younger woman's husband. They never found a body. Nothing was ever really, really proven. But it's one of these things where I had motive, means, and opportunity. And but they were in that area too, like right outside of Simi Valley. So there's just something about that one little region that kind of attracted this bad cult energy. I also know somebody who had been murdered up there when was it? It would have been the late 80s, early 90s. And for a while they thought his body had been found by the train tracks up there. And for a while they thought that had been a ritual murder because it had happened on either a quarter or cross quarter holiday. But it turned out that he'd gone up there to do a little private ritual, and his psychotic roommate had followed him up and offed him. So bad juju up there at just kind of west of Stony Point and that whole highway area leading to that connects the valley with Simi Valley.
Yeah, that's the other weird thing up there. There's all the other bad juju up there. Rocket Dyne's up there. They had a very bad... Well, then nobody really hears about these days, but they had a meltdown of a nuclear reactor there in the 1950s. Residual radiation up there. I have a friend that lives right near that. In fact, right up from where Spahn Ranch was. He had to sign an agreement that he would not sue Rocketdyne if he got cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he did get cancer.
Yep. Somewhere around here, I have one of those little local history books that you see around here about Simi Valley, and it gets into that. There's a whole section in there about what happened with Rocketdyne in the 50s, and they have a whole sections about V-11 and Krishnaventa as well, or sort of the local demons around there.
Yeah, it's almost like somebody did some kind of weird ritual there a long time ago, where it's a portal or some weird thing. You know, as in Sedona's a nice portal, but around Santa Susana Pass in the northern part of the Simi Valley there is a negative one, like a gateway to hell or something.
They say there's one of those up in the hills above Altadena, too, where Jack Parsons and used to do his various actions. And whether it was rocket launching, and then also he was a very dedicated occultist who was a friend of Aleister Crowley's and was kind of the mentor to a young cashiered Navy officer named Lafayette Ron Hubbard.
Right.
And did some very peculiar, those guys were doing some very peculiar stuff together in the late 40s in that area. And there's always been a story that they opened up a portal up there, and there's, you know, that's kind of a bad area. But oddly enough, right there is also where I mentioned earlier Joe Carson and Farrah Faria, who were really the first neo-pagans in America in the 1950s, and they got going in that area. So maybe that's more mixed up there, because I've always considered them either new or actually fairly benevolent. They're very much in Corey, sacrificed maiden, and very much tied into the kind of Cretan Minoan metaphysic and view of nature and Gaia and all that. They've always been a very small, interesting little group have that influence in that world beyond their confines. I actually, tomorrow they're doing something at Pantheacon, which is the big neo-pagan and Wiccan gathering in San Jose, and I was invited to that. So maybe I'll make it, maybe I won't, but they're a real interesting bunch of people. But so they come, yeah, they come out of that area too, just up the hill area above the San Gabriel Valley. If you just start digging anywhere around here, you'll start finding these stories and these groups and these odd things that have gone on or are going on.
Yeah, well, right. There's a lot of them in Southern California, obviously, and continue to be. The latest one you had up was the Harbin Hot Springs history, and all I knew about it was that it was a resort now. I did not know the history of all the different groups that had sort of tried to claim it for their own.
Yeah. If you've been up there, you can see why, even before it was developed to the point it is now, even when it was still kind of a wreck back in the 60s and 70s, why...
This is up near San Francisco for people that haven't read it yet.
Yeah, it's just... I've been there many times. It is... It's just very calming and peaceful, and there is something about those waters that is just. I often say, I'll go there for an afternoon, and I feel like I've had a week vacation. They have a fascinating history of the people and the organizations that have passed through there or have tried to claim it. And you know, right now, well, really, they started it 40 years ago, but. The group that runs it now is called the New Age Church of Being, and then there's another organization sort of within that that's their ministerial core. And so technically they and Sierra Hot Springs, which is up in up north of Lake Tahoe and is run by the same people, are nonprofits, are religious nonprofits. And they actually do have sacred writings and rituals and a priest and priestesshood and whatnot, so... They certainly fall under, you know, the purview of what I've been writing about, but they're linked in with so many other things that it's just fun to look into these things and kind of follow the connections and follow where they came from and where, you know, who they hung out with. I mean, the Harbin is actually very much tied in with the whole mythology of the Grateful Dead, because they did this, the Dead did this legendary show, the Fillmore in early 69 called The Celestial Synapse, which was a sort of ritual slash dance teaching, whatever thing tied in with the doctrines of this guy, Donald James Hambrick, who later was known as V. Charno, who was running Harbinger University up there, which started out as sort of kind of a techie, advanced cutting-edge technology, cutting-edge teaching organization, and then around 68 got taken over by the psychedelic counterculture and by the hippies, and it sort of became the, you know, Haight-Ashbury in the woods for a while, and they got in more and more trouble with the locals, and finally there was this point where they said, okay, let's just have one more big blowout, and Hambrick said, yeah, sure, you know, I want to have one thing to do my teachings with. So they got the Grateful Dead at the Fillmore, and they had this big Dionysian celebration there. And then when that was done, they all went up to Lake County, to Harbin as it was then. And, people can read about the rest on Calepheus Jolman. It's quite a story. And I mean, I'm trying to just dig as much as I can out of big information about these groups and present it as just entertaining and informative a way as I can on the blog. And that was actually one of my favorite things to write so far, was the Harbin piece.
Yeah, I actually read that whole thing today. And I kept thinking, oh, that must be the end of it. It keeps going and going and going, and it's still there, but it's just a retreat now. I mean, like a spa. It has nothing to do with any of the religious stuff that it...
They are controlled by a nonprofit religious corporation, which is a legitimate church, but the real nutty stuff of the earlier days has passed. That was a whole different phase.
Well, what nutty stuff can we talk about? There's tons of it. I mean, there's Southern California-based stuff, like we've been talking about. Manly Hall, I noticed you wrote about in January. I haven't read that one yet.
That is a fascinating story. Manly Hall and the Philosophical Research Society. Manly T. Hall may have been the most prolific author on occult or esoteric subjects and lecturer on the same in history. He had a 70-year career. He started when he was 18 or 19, writing and talking to audiences, and he kept going until his death at 89. He never stopped and just produced huge amounts of material, including the real classic book, The Secret Teachings of All Ages.
Yes.
And if you've ever seen it, it's this coffee table-sized book of basically this massive compilation of his research about the esoteric traditions of the world, and beautifully illustrated. And he really got his sort of collected teachings done under the aegis of the Philosophical Research Society. And both he and they have very interesting histories, which I wrote about there, right up to the fact that he may have been murdered. There has never been an indictment ruled. The person who was the suspect died years ago. But very, very dark and troubling facts about his death, which I go into on the blog, and what led up to his death, the circumstances therein. Another thing he did was he probably got the first movie from a Hollywood studio really accurately based on occult or esoteric aspects produced and distributed, and that was When Were You Born? And it starred Anna Mae Wong, who was the first Asian-American movie star.
Yeah.
As an occult, she was an occult detective, and the whole plot and the characters in it were based on the signs of the zodiac and the relationships between the signs of the zodiac. And way ahead of its time, both in starring a woman of color as the main star, and also just introducing these concepts into the Hollywood mainstream.
This is a lot. Can you see this film? Did prints of it survive?
I've seen bits of it. You can get at it. I think there's a piece of it on YouTube. I think there's some in some other places. It's not that great a film, but when you look at what he was trying to do with it, and place this whole plot around really the teachings of Western astrology and the aspects of the zodiac, and work it into this kind of noir murder plot, it's very intriguing. That was just one of the many things he did. He had a tremendous influence. He was also Elvis Presley's favorite living writer. Presley was a big fan of The Secret Teachings of All Ages, and got him to autograph his copy, and very interesting connections the man had, and interesting fans. He performed the wedding ceremony for Bela Lugosi and his last wife. He performed the wedding ceremony 30 years later for Charles Bukowski and Linda Lee Bailey. Really, he got around. And very, very interesting story. Most of what I wrote there is really based on a book called Master of the Mysteries by Louis Sahagun, who just did incredible spade work in digging out this history of this man, which just had not been really known beforehand.
Yeah, is there a biography of Manly Hall? There's got to be by now.
That's it. Master of the Mysteries, Louis Sahagun.
Okay. When was that published?
Carroll House Press, yeah.
So that was published in the last few years. That's right.
Yeah. And I used other sources too, but that was the main one. I mean, it's just really fascinating what he did.
Where did he come out of nowhere, or was he associated with like the Golden Dawn or something? Or
he kind of came out of nowhere. He was a Canadian by birth, and he showed up in L.A. as a late teenager around the end of World War One, and was hanging out with this guy Sidney Brownson, who was sort of a local occultist and esoteric figure and teacher around Santa Monica. And Brownson took him under his wing and taught him everything he knew and gave him sources to learn more. And he started, he's a young, good-looking, charismatic guy, so he was able to start attracting little audiences to himself for lecture tours and whatnot. And he became the, at 19, he became the minister at the Church of the People, which was a sort of universalist semi-mystical sect in Los Angeles, and really got going there, and attracted some fairly rich and influential people into his orbit too. And that was how he was able to get the Secret Teachings of All Ages, which was prohibitively expensive at the time. It was $100 in the 20s, which is like $1,000 or $1,200 now.
Yeah.
Published and out. It's he was pretty much a self-made man. He just was self-taught. He dropped out of school in the seventh grade. And was an autodidact and just was this absolute expert on the more outre aspects of world religion and spirituality.
As you say, he had an influence on a lot of the creative and political life of Southern California, for L.A. for quite a while. And people, I think who was there was a mayor of Los Angeles that was good friends with
Mayor
him.
Yorty. Yes.
Yorty.
Very conservative mayor who presented him with an award in a private ceremony because he still didn't want to be associated publicly with the guy, even though he thought he was a genius and loved him. It just still didn't want to alienate his constituents. There's also a writer named Mitch Horowitz who believes that that Manly Hall may have influenced Ronald Reagan.
Not hard to believe.
Yeah. It's who he wrote this very, very Hall wrote this very patriotic work called The Secret Destiny of America during World War II. And if you read it, you really begin to kind of understand why Horowitz made this connection. Is because it's beyond the flag waving. There's this whole kind of idealism about America as the new Atlantis, America as the new Jerusalem, that this is going to be the place that leads the rest of the world into enlightenment and goodness and whatever. And a lot of the rhetoric does sound very similar to the whole Morning in America pitch that Reagan did. So I don't know if I quite believe it, but it's possible. Because again, Hall was very tight with a lot of people in Hollywood, so I can see a younger Ronald Reagan reading this, and it just kind of seeping into his subconscious and becoming part of his whole political shtick and political views later.
Yeah, it's Hall. I mean, and his influence and his work. There was so much inertia behind it that it's still going and the building is still there and there's still a Philosophical Research Society, 20 years after his death?
Yeah. They're now accredited by the state and the feds as a degree-granting institution. They're still going. I think that's always been an issue with any new religion or sect or cult. Will it survive the death of the founder?
Yeah.
Some of them do. Some of them become even bigger after the founder is gone. Some of them fade out slowly. It depends. And there's an example of one that has survived and is doing pretty well over 25 years after, well, not 25 years, but decades after after Mr. Hall passed on.
Yeah. Now I really want to go get that that biography. Because I've always knew about Manly. Oh, I got a question, and I don't know if you went into it on your blog, but how did anybody say anything about Sirhan's interest in the Philosophical Research Society at the time?
I don't know, because Sirhan was certainly involved with the AMORC, with the Rosicrucian organization.
Okay.
He was definitely interested in consciousness change and expansion, hypnosis, things like that. And yeah, I would not be surprised if he'd sat in on a couple of Hall's lectures or had some of that influence. I have generally stayed away from speculation about things like that. I'll mention the connection if it's known, like the connection between Elvis and at all. I would have to do more research to really find out if you know, what, if anything, Sir Hans Sirhan had done, had picked up from the PRS and from Hall.
Yeah, well, I think there's a, as far as I can remember, there was a definite connection where he either had attended some lectures, had bought a few books or taken some courses from the PRS, but I don't know if anybody ever made a connection or said any, because, you know, Hall was still very much alive and doing things when all this went on. So I don't know if anybody ever bugged him about it or said, hey, look what happened or anything like that.
Yeah. One of the things I kicked myself about is I was not able to go see Hall when he was still alive and lecturing. I was told by several people, Mike, you're interested in this sort of stuff. This is the 80s. You've got to see this guy. He's like the grand old man. He's been doing this stuff from the beginning, from World War One era.
Yeah.
And he's very old and sick, but you got to see him. And I didn't, and too bad. But, interesting character.
Yeah, I heard about him probably right around when he died. I mean, I was just getting interested in that stuff because of Robert Anton Wilson and all the stuff that flowed from that, all of my readings of his stuff.
Oh, yeah.
because it was, all this stuff is, it's kind of related. You start getting involved in it. I was even a member of the Builders of the Adytum for about 2 years.
Oh, yes. Paul Foster Case.
Yeah.
They're an interesting group. One group I actually sort of consult for, not really going to go into the details. I just have, they have sort of asked me for my expertise on ritual and spiritual groups and, esoteric teachings and whatnot, because they're beginning to explore that aspect of what they do. The leader was involved for a short time with the BOTA and has some connections down there. So yeah, they've had quite the influence. And they're still around. They still have their little group down there in just east of downtown LA.
Yeah. They're up on Figueroa.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
On North Figueroa. I've been there. I took the course there because this was in the early 90s. I did it by mail. I had the correspondence course, and I went through the first grade.
those innocent pre-internet days. I remember them.
Yeah, I know they have stuff. They have online courses now, but yeah, they would send me something every couple of weeks. I'd read the stuff, then they'd send me it like after about a year of this, they'd send me the test. It was like, I don't know if it was an open book test, but it was just a test. You had to answer all the questions about, the Tree of Life and tarot and the basic ideas of Western occultism and all that. So I think I attained neophyte status or something like that, whatever the first grade was.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
mentioning that part of L.A., it reminded me, I have not accepted certainly I was talking about William Mooney earlier.
Yeah.
I've not accepted Christian groups from my purview, and a very interesting group that was for many, many years in East L.A. was what's called the Mexican National Catholic Church.
Never heard
of
them.
They were survival of a group that had originated just after the Revolution in 1916, whose whole purpose was to become kind of a patriotic, nationalistic, Spanish-speaking, Hispano-centric.
Okay, I have heard of it.
Church, because there were so many, because there had been such problems over the years between the governments of Mexico and the RCC, and it finally kind of came to a head when you had this very anti-clerical revolutionary government coming. And they said, let's set up this little alternative here. And it lasted for a while in Mexico, but then they finally decided, nah, let's just get the RCC to pay us some money, and we'll let them operate again. And it began to fade, but they had this last survival for many, many years over on what's now Cesar Chavez Avenue in this guy's house, who was like a bishop of it. And they have a really interesting history too, as this sort of sect that was created largely for political and cultural reasons, as to kind of attempt to undercut the power of the RCC and create this very Latino centric and Spanish speaking and very, Viva Mexico national church. And that it's funny, it died out in Mexico, but lasted for many years in L.A., and now it's starting up again, strangely enough, and I get into that, too.
When you say RCC, do you mean something Catholic Church?
Roman Catholic Church.
Oh, Roman Catholic
Roman
Church.
Roman Catholic Church,
of course.
Yeah.
Do you think you'll... Go ahead.
No, so, yeah, so that's in there, too. I talk about their history, and, you know, very interesting group.
Do you think that you... I don't know how much of it is spread. I know some of it's spread to Southern California. The basically the cults of different saints of Mexico, like the Santo Muerte, and
that's really a Mexican phenomenon that's been imported here.
Yeah.
So I leave that out of it, and that is something that's still kind of under the purview of the sort of folk Catholicism of the Latino culture, rather than a distinct movement.
That's true, because they don't have their own.
Yeah. So as interesting as it is, I don't really go there.
Oh, okay. The most shocking, horrible, scary thing I read on your site, I bet you know what I'm talking about. And they still exist.
There's a few of them there, but I want to hear what you think the worst one is.
Well, so far that I've read was the Church of God, I think. David Byrne.
Children of God.
Children of God, that's it. Absolutely crazy.
Oh, yes. Forty fishing.
The only thing that's missing from that is murder, I think.
Yeah.
Except
they
at the end. I said, except at the end, there actually is a little murder.
Yeah, yeah. Just to kind of briefly go over who they were and are, it was a Christian sect that began in 1968 in Huntington Beach and was really ministering to the hippie counterculture of the time. And because of the particular oddness of the sect leader's teachings, he was David Berg, who'd been an evangelist for many years and had kind of gone counterculture in his middle age.
Yeah.
He came up with this very beyond sex positive teaching. It really became very exploitative, using their members basically as sacred prostitutes to literally seduce people into the faith and raising children in this very erotic environment where it was said, we need to get rid of the repression that, you know, they've gotten under Judeo-Christian civilization, under American civilization. And so they started encouraging a lot of this stuff, and it ended up in some very, very bad places. And I have a very extensive writings about them. They're based on the writings of Don Layton, as well as some of the academic pseudo-apologists for them as well. I've tried to be as objective as I can, but the facts about them, at least their past behaviors, are pretty scurvy. So I get into the story of the Children of the God, a.k.a. the family as well, on the blog.
Can you get into any of that while we're on the air here?
Yeah, well, you mentioned they've ended in a murder-suicide. They basically, David Burdick had raised, I guess it would have been a stepson, because it was his second, third wife's child by a hotel worker in the Canary Islands, and Davidito. And he was raised to be the sort of perfect child with no sexual guilt, with no hang-ups about his body or whatever. And it just, because of what he went through, it just messed him up very, very badly. And he ended up murdering one of his old nannies down in Tucson, Arizona, and then committing suicide in California. And it also, before he did all this, had actually threatened to go out and kill other people, too, because he'd just been so damaged. And they have a pretty bad history in that aspect. And they say they changed it in the late 80s. They stopped flirty fishing, which was basically the sacred prostitution they would do. They stopped the things with kids, but it's a hell of a legacy, and I discuss it there.
Yeah, it's actually really surprising. Well, you know what? People didn't have it wasn't the pedophilia was not a hot button topic in the 1970s.
That's correct. Yeah.
1970s
and
80s.
The 70s. It was a little different. Yeah, yeah.
People didn't really pay too much attention to it or think it was that big of a deal. And, we're, you know, we've got this idea now that it's absolutely horrible, which of course it is. But people didn't
– Yeah.
It wasn't a big as big of a deal back then. So they probably – right now they would probably be stopped immediately. But then it went on for years.
Yeah, yeah.
And messed up a lot of people. I mean, not just – the guy you talk about that killed himself and his old nanny, but many people are probably, they're probably in years of therapy or maybe not and just suffering now because of it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, River Phoenix had been, brother of Chuck, Joaquin had been raised in that, and he claimed he lost his virginity when he was 4, and he ended up drugging himself to death in a Hollywood gutter on Halloween night. And I think he was definitely affected by it. I don't know about how much his brother was, but I think very much River Phoenix, whose parents were children of God who'd been raised in it, was kind of his death was kind of a mute tribute to what it can do to one being raised in that world.
Right. Yeah, well, I think he OD'd and fell down outside the door of the Viper Room and died there.
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah.
On Sunset Boulevard there. Why are you interested in this? I mean, apart from, it seems like a natural progression from the Weird California, but it's a very specific interest, a very, you know, a pathology.
You mentioned Robert Anton Wilson earlier.
Yeah.
Way back at 1985, I went to a lecture he did in West GLA, and he was doing his usual shtick of having this very free-ranging examination of a very wide variety of odd topics, and the subject of the JFK assassination came up, and he started talking about David Ferry, who is one of the characters in several of the different conspiracy theories, and is just a fascinating individual in his own right. A book about him came out very recently that I read and was kind of entertained by, and he mentioned out of nowhere, Wilson mentioned, well, Ferry was a bishop in the old Catholic Church,
yes,
not the regular Catholic Church, the sect. I said, what the hell is that? So being a researcher and somebody intrigued by these things and having, at the time I was working at UCLA at a think tank there and had access to the wonderful, what's now the, what is it now? It was the UCRSC Research Library now. It's named now after one of the heads of the university. I forget his name. But I had access to this place, and so I just, with the technology and the references of the time, I just started looking, what's the old Catholic Church? I found that there is this, not only is that there's this fascinating underground in Christianity of all these men and women that are bishops that claim to be carrying on the real Catholic Church lineage and have their own little sects and groups and whatever, but there's this fascinating religious and spiritual diversity in America that I've not really suspect until I started reading some of this, some of the literature about it. And I was completely fascinated, partly because I saw these people, and I still do, I see a lot of this as almost like unconscious performance art.
Uh-huh.
It's people taking a concept and just kind of living it out in this very artistic and creative, odd sort of way, with a metaphysical rationale under it. I saw these partly as people seeking power or wealth or recognition in unusual ways and in a way that are very much off the mainstream, supposedly normal ways of doing it. And there were just so many interesting stories attached to them. I've always been fascinated by eccentric people and eccentric groups and things that don't quite fit in, and here was just an absolute goldmine of this sort of stuff. And so, yeah, this has been going on now with me for almost 30 years. I've been studying it, and now it's finally taking shape in a more focused literary fashion by trying to get the information I have out there, and really with this California-centric focus, I could just go on forever if I just wanted to do all of the U.S. and certainly the world.
Yeah.
But I wanted to really have a narrower focus to begin with because it's just easier to get a handle on.
So a lot of people have mentioned this and said and tried to codify it, and there have been a few attempts. What's the difference between, to you, what's the difference between a religion and a cult?
Political power.
What'd you say?
Did you really want to get down to it? I think all the great religions, all the great spiritual paths started out as cults. Christianity certainly was this very heretical Jewish messianic group, mm-hmm. in its early years that started to spread to Gentiles as well under Paul. Certainly Islam was this attempt to meld things of Judaism and Christianity with these sort of Arab tribal traditions. Buddhism certainly was a spin-off of Hinduism, right. Under Siddhartha Gautama.
Uh-huh.
And very, you know, very cultish when it began. This is just, to me, it's a natural state of, I think, about any group, and certainly we can say that about the Mormons, who have some very peculiar beginnings and very lurid things in their earlier history, and now are really accepted as this kind of establishment, I guess, bit odd version of Christianity, and this whole kind of culture unto themselves in the United States and increasingly in other countries. So, really, the word cult, though, has become so pejorative that I try not to use it, unless it is a really negative group, like, say, the Manson family, or People's Temple, or Heaven's Gate, or something like that, where it really was bad things that came out of the kind of warped vision of a very warped leader. I try to confine the use of the C word really to your more obviously negative and obviously destructive groups. Otherwise, they're sects or new religions or spiritual groups or whatnot.
I would totally agree with you on that.
Yeah. And once again, thanks, Joe Carson, and the spirit of the great Frederick Adams for coming up with the Calathea's reference, because it certainly plays in with my orientation towards California history and culture. At the same time, gets that kind of fanciful element in there that I like for the project.
I thought at some point you said you were going to write a book about it, but it seems like you're just putting it on.
Eventually, I want to compile what I'm writing into a book.
Yeah.
Into hard copy. I'm just trying to get the information that I already have out now, and it's kind of been stimulating me writing some new stuff as well. But this is just how it stands right now. Is the blog will eventually evolve into a hard copy book or an e-book.
I have a book, and I can't remember the title of it, but it's got kind of a, I think it has a picture of the, what's that complex in San Diego the Theosophists had? I think it has a picture of one of the...
Point Loma.
Yeah, the Point Loma Theosophical group. And it's called California Religions or California Cults or something like that. It was published like in the...
California's Utopian Colony.
That's it, Utopian
Colony. Robert Hines.
That's right.
Yeah, I have that book, yeah. And that fits into it, too. I am writing about the Theosophists, both the mainstream sort of establishment group, which has Cretona. It's in the Ojai, but it was originally in Hollywood. They still have a few buildings left in Hollywood, but the main operation is now in Ojai.
Yeah, well, they're...
And the Point Loma group, which was the Catherine Tingley people,
right,
which is another faction of Theosophy.
Yeah, the buildings are still there, and it's now the Point Loma Nazarene University. So Catholics are taking it over.
Yeah. It's the Church of the Nazarene runs it, and then there's an interesting group out in the whole area around Arroyo Grande and Pismo Beach and all that. I believe they're actually in Grover Beach, and they're called the Temple of the People, and they were another odd little split off from Theosophy, and they have this kind of, I don't know if it's octagonal or circular or what, but it's a very strange little temple out there, and they still have their daily services and do things out there, and they're kind of a little remnant of that era on the 1910s and 1920s when it was really, the whole thing was really taking off in both California and the Western world.
Yeah, there were. It seems like the somewhere between the beginning of the century and maybe the First World War, kind of kicked it into high gear, and then the First World War kind of slowed it down a bit. Picked up again, I guess, like 1950s, late 50s, and then up to the present, I would suppose.
Yeah, it goes through phases, really. That was the hot period. One of the hot periods was like the 1890s to the 1910s, and I've heard from somebody once, they've said that spiritualism was very, very big until World War I. Because what happened was so many people started trying to contact the spirits of their boys who had died out in the battlefields and were not successful or were getting static or whatnot, that it just kind of got abandoned by a lot of people. And after theosophy began kind of a decline after Krishnamurti rejected his role as the great world avatar and kind of went off in his own direction. Lots of stuff happening in the 1920s. And then the Depression, I think, put an end to a lot of it. And a lot of it kicked in again as California began to really fill up after World War II. And you had a lot of people coming in here and a lot of activity, people looking for answers, new things, whatnot. And, of course, the 50s, the Beatniks discovering Zen and various Eastern teachings, and then things really blowing up with the 60s counterculture and the New Age in the 1980s. And it's always been around. And there's these various kind of waves that keep hitting. And nowhere, I think, on Earth that's stronger than here. This kind of perennial philosophy is of just looking for answers. There's a great short story by English writer Robert Aikman called Larger Than Oneself, about what happens if you try to get all the people who are into this stuff together in one place doing what they're doing. And what happens is rather weird, as Mr. Aikman's stories often are. So it just reminded me of that. And it's just kind of a hot center. What happens in a hot center where you have so much of this stuff going on? And certainly L.A. area, Bay Area, certain other places around the state have this all happening.
Yeah, well, they start in these urban areas, and then they sequester the members somewhere so that the control can be exercised, I think. About the only one that didn't do that, I think, maybe, as far as I know, is Scientology, which has always been pretty much, it was centered in Los Angeles and grew out from there.
Yeah, well, it for a while was in New Jersey. But I think one of the things that really made Hubbard kind of a genius was he figured out just how strong the cult of celebrity and of Hollywood is in not only the U.S., but just all over the world. And he really... he'd kind of cut his teeth out here in occultism and odd things and whatever, working with the OTO and with Jack Parsons in the late 1940s. So he was very familiar with the area when he kind of came back here in the 50s and 60s. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, established the operation here really in the 60s, 70s, whatever. He was at sea most of the year, first in Britain and then at sea, kind of away from the governments of the world. But I think you really realize the power of the entertainment media and the power of the cachet of celebrity. And so he really wanted to have it in Hollywood and associated with all that, where they could really ingratiate themselves very closely with the movie and the TV communities. That's the reason why there has never been a film, unless you want to count The Master, which is kind of a clumsy Romana Clay, there's never been a film about Hubbard, who I consider an absolutely fascinating character. Really one of the great sort of adventurers in his own way of the 20th century, when what he put together is considered, and it would just be a mind-blowing movie, but they can't make one because there's so many Scientologists in the film industry who would not want it, not want the story told. So that's why they kind of had to sneak around them and do The Master. And The Master, to me, is much as I love Philip Seymour Hoffman and Joaquin Phoenix, I think they did a great job in it. They put little bits of his history there and played it, you know, and then had the Joaquin Phoenix character being in his experiences being kind of the center of it. But no, it's so far beyond that.
Yeah.
So I'm going to be writing about Hubbard and Scientology too, which I just consider in many ways the most controversial and the most visible group that ever came out of here, possibly rivaled only by Charles Manson, which is much smaller and was confined really to a few dozen antisocial misfits, as opposed to Scientology, whose influence has been immense around the world.
When I published the story of L. Ron Hubbard and Jack Parsons at first, before the Sex and Rockets, biography.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Scientology started writing me and would not leave me alone for like a year and a half.
Yeah. They do that.
Are you scared that'll happen to you? Are you scared that'll happen to you?
No. The main reason is because because of the rise of the internet now, so much of their stuff is out there and it's documented so heavily.
Yeah.
That I think a lot of them have realized they can't really use these intimidation tactics as, you know, because it's the horse is out of is left the stable long ago. And I know there's a lot of very sincere and good Scientologists out there, but unfortunately they have their goon squads within the org have a reputation of doing some pretty nasty things. And I have not, maybe I don't really follow that world enough lately, but it seems like it has really subsided with the publication of the OT levels on the internet. It's basically public domain now.
Yeah.
With a lot of the revelations about them, I think they've really had to do damage control in the last few years and just not really have the heavy-handed counterattacks against critics like they used to.
Yeah, well, like you said, they really can't. Oh, here comes your siren here, just so everybody will know this is actually Radio Mysterioso. There you go. Do you know about this, Mike? There's a siren, at least one, on every show. There it goes.
I did not know about that.
Yeah, it's a tradition here. Anyway, the funny thing was that as soon as I said, please send me a letter with your concerns and I will publish it. And as soon as I published it, they stopped bothering me.
Yeah.
And it was very strange. And I even made fun of the letter and I just said, this letter really doesn't make any sense. This is proved. But they didn't care as long as they had their say.
Yeah. And that's fine. I mean, they have the right to object, but the whole way they have often done it has been pretty out of bounds. In many ways, and as I say, I don't really. In 2015, I have very little fear of problems from them. I think they've really pulled back on a lot of that stuff.
Yeah,
and okay. I'm just one of
they got
many,
a lot bigger
many,
fish to fry.
Many people writing about them. Yeah, they have bigger fish to fry than some. You know, some guy up in Marin County and his little blog, which may become a book sometime. I mean, there's just so many critical books of them out there too, and pieces and whatever. They can't control it anymore. In the 50s, 60s, 70s, they could control this stuff. They could do it.
Yeah, by buying up all copies.
Now.
Yeah, buying up all copies of books or whatever. It's just you can't do that now because it's It just gets out, and it's you can't chase every server around and try and get rid of stuff you don't like. So,
mm-hmm. And it's they've always interested me, and Hubbard I just consider an absolutely fascinating character.
He is. I can't, like you said, I can't believe unless Scientology just either loses most of its membership or, you know, becomes a historical footnote or something, mm-hmm. Nobody's going to be able to do any kind of, not even critical, but just like as straight as they can biography of them or biopic or TV series anything, which would be, would be fascinating.
Yeah. There's an excellent biography of him written years ago by Russell Miller called Barefaced Messiah.
Yes, I
and
have that.
That was actually, that is a great, great book. And that just, in the introduction, it makes a very salient point, which is Hubbard lied so much about his background and his life and his qualifications and whatever. You know, he was a storyteller. He was a fiction writer. He wrote pulp fiction, was a very effective and prolific pulp fiction writer. So he was a storyteller. And he just built up this image of himself as this Superman. And the ironic thing is, if you look at his life and what he really did, what his document that he was able to do, it outstrips all of his fiction about himself. He was the real story is far more fascinating and improbable than any of the nonsense that he came up with to tell his followers or to tell the outside world. And to me, I just consider that totally fascinating. When you are a storyteller living in your own story that is bigger and weirder than anything you could possibly concoct as a writer or a fantasist.
I'm sure being right in the middle of it, he didn't even realize how strange it was. It was just normal to him.
Yeah. I think that's true with a lot of people, a lot of creative or eccentric people. You start living out your own myth, and you don't realize you're living out your own myth. And I think he's certainly in that tradition.
That's funny you say that, and the first thing I thought of was William Burroughs lecturing about different authors, and he said that's what happens to some terrible, horrible things happen to certain authors who start trying to live their characters out. And he said one of them was Hemingway.
Oh yeah. And of course in music, in popular music, a classic example of that would be Jim Morrison of the Doors.
Somebody
just got caught up in his own myth.
I never really thought about that, but that makes total sense. Then he wrote himself into decline too, apparently. Or no, that wasn't it. He did not write himself into it. In trying to live up to it, he came up short.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe it's probably a good thing that he didn't, because part of his even if he really got going. We're talking about Morrison here, I assume. This whole sort of like self-sacrifice, self-destruction as a core of your whole act as a performer. And I've often said, well, he kind of mapped that out, but he sort of backed off and then died from things before he could really do it. Iggy Pop got it going and then veered off that path just in time, so he didn't really destroy himself. And then you have somebody who just took it completely literally and took it to the end, and that would be G.G. Allen.
Yeah.
But not
the way he thought he would.
Yeah, this pure id out there, this pure self-destruction, all of the bad stuff and nastiness and whatever of the rock and roll myth in one guy.
Yeah, taken to a ridiculous extreme, and then dying in a way that a lot of other rock and roll people have died, and not in this blaze of glory. He just OD'd.
Yeah, he just OD'd. Which is probably what would have happened to Iggy Pop if he hadn't cleaned up in time. It's funny, the whole thing about getting caught up in one's own myth, or how far are you going to push it? How much separation are you going to have between your art and your life? Do they become the same thing? And this is, again, why religion, spirituality, sectarianism, and particularly people that start them and lead them, intrigue me so much, because you have this playing out so much in their lives that you become, when you set yourself up as this authority, as this spiritual, as this avatar or whatnot, what happens? What happens to you as a person? And this is something I really like to, I'm exploring a lot in Califia's Children, about how this all gets played out with the men and women who start these groups and lead them, and the people that get involved with them, the lieutenants, the people that take over for the founders. And I mean, a guy that I've written about who's very obscure, but I find fascinating in his own life is Art Bula, who is a Mormon fundamentalist, who is situated down in the Sonoran Desert and sort of spends some of his time in California and a lot in Baja, in San Felipe, and he's basically a Mormon prophet with virtually no following, and he's he's an ideological polygamist who's unmarried, has no wife. And somebody like this who has kind of become his own Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, Moroni, whatever figure, and has lived it out for his life for many, many years with little or no result or reward, but keeps going. To me, there's just, again, it's almost like performance art. It's almost like living like your life like a piece of performance art.
Yeah, I did a lecture once called "The 1950s UFO Contactees." Were they an unrecognized art movement?
There's something to be said for that. Certainly, Carl Jung, among other people, saw the religious aspects of UFO contactees and wrote about it quite a bit.
Yes.
I am going to be covering one or two contactee groups, most notoriously Heaven's Gate,
right,
and a couple others. So yeah, this is just, it's endlessly intriguing. This sort of like interplay between humans and the divine, whatever that is, and how they interpret it and how it sort of comes into their lives and the lives of people around them and what they do with it and how it gets coded and symbolized and passed on and how it affects the world and the culture around it, in its own way. Certainly, somebody like Manson, who I consider in his own way, a very false prophet and a very misguided spiritual leader, the influence of that guy on popular culture, on the American view of the penal system and crime, in all sorts of ways, has just been huge. He just tapped into something, some kind of archetype of the wild man and the evil, guru, you know, Rasputinian guru out to seduce your children, so strongly that, you know, here's this broken down little 80-year-old guy in isolation in Corcoran.
Yeah.
But he has just become this folk demon beyond. The rather limited violence and horror of Helter Skelter, which was compared to the meltdowns of groups like People's Temple or Heaven's Gate or even the doings of various serial killers around California since then has been actually kind of minor. But he tapped into something, and still has it.
Yeah, he still does. He keeps popping up in the news. There was that woman that wanted to marry him for his dead body or something when he died.
Oh yeah, I love that. It
sounds like an Onion piece.
I heard about her. I was reading about her and I commented about it. I said, you go to prison as a notorious mass killer and you'll get groupies. The odds are good, but the problem is the goods are odd. and that's one of the oddest ones I've heard of yet is that young lady. I whenever there's a good story about him in the news, I always have this obnoxious posting that I do on Facebook, just like with Esquire magazine's Dubious Achievements Awards, when Nixon was still around, would make the news. They'd always have an old picture of him, and it would say, "Why is this man smiling?" With me, it's always whenever there's a story about Charlie's latest doings, I always post it, kind of now, kind of wow, Charlie.
Which, always.
Again, if you were a kid in the 70s and remember those commercials, it's a reference to that, but I think it just sums up the whole, his regular presence in the media pretty well.
Yeah, he keeps coming back like the undead. It's amazing.
Oh, yeah. It's,
Okay, we got half an hour left, Mike. What is the most weirdest one you've uncovered yet? I mean, the one that just, like, pushes all your buttons and makes you go gaga. What have you written about your favorite?
I would say, and I've actually known about them for many years. I know both the founders personally, and it's a group which was in San Francisco and Berkeley in the early and mid 1970s, called the Psychedelic Venus Church. They evolved out of the old Sexual Freedom League, which was in the 60s that sort of this group very much involved with trying to loosen up attitudes about premarital sex and nudity and homosexuality and sex outside of marriage. Multiple partner stuff and polyamory and things like that we're getting into. And the kind of hedonistic philosophy got translated into a spiritual way with the Psychedelic Venus Church, which combined what they were doing with the use of cannabis and other substances for consciousness expansion, tied in with sacred sex practices. And to me, oh man, this is like the ultimate kind of hippie counterculture hedonist. Basically an excuse to get high and get laid in the name of spirituality group. And they lasted for most of the 70s and had some activity, mostly in the Bay Area, and influenced a few groups around here. And they have a very interesting story. And their leader, they had a couple leaders. There was Mother Boats, who's now in Australia, and Jeff Poland, who was the founder of the Sexual Freedom League, who is still around and is in San Francisco and still does various things in his 70s under a pseudonym, and there's reasons for him using the pseudonym that I'll get into in the writing. But to me, that was like the ultimate one. I just said, oh, This is like the greatest designer cult I've ever heard of. Just sex and drugs and complete, you know, and then this whole kind of not real focus, but basically goddess spirituality and neo-paganism. So they're I'm writing about them now. I'll publish my part on them in a little bit. To me, they were just like that's the one I always just really had the most fun with. Yeah, you know, it's, well, somebody was really, you know. Yeah. That would be it for me. Although there's others that really intrigue me as well, fascinate me, and just, you know, to me are very informative about the people and the cultures and the circumstances and, you know, people's attempts to deal with and follow the divine, whatever that may be, however they might define that.
What do you think draws people? I mean, this is a question that's been asked hundreds of times, but what's your idea? I hear about all these things. I'm reading all these things on the Children of Califia site, and I'm reading it going, boy, as soon as somebody says, why don't you X, like, give us all your stuff, or as soon as I got to give part of myself away, I go, ah, and I run the other way.
Yeah.
Why? Yeah. I mean, what do you think is the profile? What do the people tap into? Like, if I wanted to start a religion, what would I tap into? People's insecurities?
Sense of belonging, I think, is a big one. Creation of a tribe, creation of a people, creation of a family outside of the family. I think that's a huge thing for people. We don't always have the best relationships with our blood family.
Yeah.
We don't always feel like we fit into the social milieu we're raised in or work in or live in or whatever. But we have that human need to feel part of something bigger, and to feel part of a group, part of a family, part of a tribe. And I think that's a huge, huge thing for people getting involved in these things. I think the need for answers, the need for a sort of prevailing mythos or story or narrative, a grand narrative for one's life and explanation for one's existence and for why bad things happen, why good things happen. is certainly cultural assertion. I deal with groups like the Mexican Catholic Church and a couple of African American groups when you have groups that have been historically put down. The need to create solidarity in these groups by having a metaphysical rationale. There's a lot of reasons, and I go into them sometimes in my writings, and really once the book is put together, I think it's something I'll cover in the foreword about, well, what's behind all this? And I think it's a very universal and eternal and timeless needs that people have that these tap into. I think also a need for transcendent experience. Just this afternoon, I was over at my neighbor's place and we were talking, and the whole subject of, we were watching her little dog kind of run in circles, and the whole subject of even animals need these sort of like altered experiences. They need to kind of play with their brains a little bit and their central nervous system to be in a different state of consciousness. And certainly with human beings, we've got drugs, we've got meditation, we've got sex, we've got exercise, and prayer, spiritual practices and all that are a very powerful way to tap into whatever this higher altered state is.
And the other weird thing, and people don't think about this, when you're talking about something that might be a cult or Adam Gorightly has a question too, which I'll get to. But when you're mm-hmm. thinking about a cult or religion, a sect or whatever, not all of them are horribly bad for the people involved.
No, not at all. I already mentioned Fair Faria, who I think are very positive and beautiful and life-giving little sect. There are others that I think do very good work. I mean, even Scientology, as demonized as they are, I think there are some of the practices in Dianetics, which was the original writing on this, on change of consciousness in life by Hubbard, are absolutely valid. It's just other things start getting tacked on to that. It becomes this sort of dogmatic thing after a while, and then you start having the abuses. Yeah. No, I think again, it's because the bad stuff dominates the media. You know,
right.
We hear about Manson, we hear about People's Temple, Heaven's Gate, whatnot. Understood. These are big, big news items. These are
right.
bad things people need to hear about, but you don't hear about a lot of the great personal growth and building of communities and creative sort of ways of approaching and coding the human divine experience that many of the other groups that I talk about there do. Whether they be Christian or neo-pagan or Eastern-oriented or New Age or whatnot. It's not, and that's, and again, why I shied away from using the word cult in the title. Because it has such a negative connotation, and to me, it's just not that simple. There's just a lot more going on than, you know, the stereotypical guru using his followers for sex and money and power, and then the whole thing kind of melting down in some gun or domino. That
yeah.
happens, obviously.
Yeah, of course it does.
But there's many, many other stories and sort of collective trajectories groups out there that need to be told about. Yeah, you know, if they've been written about before, I'm just the first person who I think is looking at it from the aspect of this is part of our culture and our history in this state. Although I might say that somebody like Eric Davis, who wrote Visionary State, preceded me. It's just, I think he was looking in Visionary State more at the physical remains and influences of the group on the land, the architecture and the land and whatnot, where I'm really oriented myself more towards the people.
Yeah, the sociological aspect.
Yeah, that's a great book too, but I'm not putting him down at all. I'm just saying his focus was somewhat different
yeah.
than mine.
The reason I said that some of them do good stuff is that Adam Gorightly is listening. He said, "Ask Mike his take on Krishnamurti."
Yeah, I will be talking. He was very interesting figure, and writer and leader. And he had a very odd backstory himself. He was pretty much chosen to be the new Messiah, the new Avatar, by Charles Wilson Leadbeater, who was the ranking, I think at one point he was the leader of the Theosophical Society, and he was also one of the co-founders of what's called the Liberal Catholic Church, which is a non-papal Christian church that has this big theosophical element in its liturgy and in its teachings. And he was set up to be, from like adolescence, to be the Messiah. And then when he turned like 27, 28, thereabouts, he just said, screw this. I don't want this.
Yeah.
And walked away and became his own teacher and leader. And yeah, very, very interesting figure. And I think had a lot of very good things to say.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. He's atypical cult type thing. I think he actually encouraged people to go away.
Yeah,
it's like you don't need me. You don't need this. And if people stayed, fine. Mm-hmm. If not, he didn't care.
Yeah, yeah. Almost subgenius in a way. In some ways, a Discordian. Yes. Yeah, you're your own pope. You know, go and do likewise.
It's funny. I grew up here. Well, you grew up in the northern part of the state.
No, I grew up in Santa Monica.
Oh, you did? What's your big thing about hating Southern California then?
About what about it?
There was something you posted on Facebook, and I wasn't going to bring it up. I'm going to bring it up now. It's like a map of the LA basin after the ice caps melt. And you said I kind of prefer it that way.
Yeah, it is the cry of a former lover of a place whose heart has been broken by it. I mean, in Santa Monica in the 60s and 70s, and as a kid, it was idyllic. And then, for me anyway, L.A. and Southern California really started to sour in the 80s. And by after the riot in 92, I just said, I got to get out of here. And I still come back, and I still have friends and family there and enjoy certain things about it, but I do maintain a little bit of emotional distance and like to put in little jibes every now and then as an adopted Northern Californian. But yeah, much material in the book takes place in L.A. and greater Los Angeles, because there's just so much that has happened there over the years spiritually and in these ways.
Okay. Well, I understand. I understand your position now. Cause when people that are not from here start putting down Southern California, I was like, then what are you doing here? Why are you even here if you hate it so much?
I'm from there. I like a lot of things about it, but I just had to get out and I'm much more comfortable up here. And I just had a little fun. Apparently, the guy did one of the Bay Area too, which I'd like to look at, because basically most of San Francisco would be underwater that way. There'd just be a few little peaks like Mount Davidson and Twin Peaks and whatnot that would be poking above the new sea line. And I'm sure where I am now would be underwater, but and this whole Central Valley would be flooded too. Again, I want to see if that guy. I've heard that guy's done more work, and I'd like to see what all that looks like as well.
Well, there'll be an island again. There'll be the mountains running down from San Luis Obispo, and a little bit north of there, down to Santa Barbara, and a little bit south of there. That will be the island of Califia.
Will come true. Yes. Well, the Spaniards for a while thought this was they go up what used to be the Gulf of California, that's the Sea of Cortez, and they figured, well, this goes all the way up and links up with the Greater Bay, must link up with the Greater Bay Area eventually.
Right.
And so, yeah, they thought it was, and well, Terry McWilliams wrote a book called An Island Called California, which was a compilation of his writings about
that's one of my favorite books.
Various other things. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, it's a good one.
Yeah, Southern California, An Island in the Land, which helped me understand the Northern Southern California rivalry. There was many times where they wanted to split California, I think around Tehachapi. No, where is it? Right, that mountain right before you go down into Bakersfield. They wanted to split Southern and Northern California right there.
Tehachapi. Yeah.
And then there's a lot more. Go ahead.
I've always said that one of the real splits is at Point Conception, that the coastline, just the whole look and the environment changes once you're north or south of there. I always say about California beaches and the coast and whatever, it's like below Point Conception is Brian Wilson land. Above Point Conception is Robinson Jeffers land. Below it, you have kind of this stereotypical Southern California, the wide sandy beach and surfing and that whole kind of mellowed out atmosphere. But when you get north of it, all of a sudden you've got the big mountains pouring into the ocean and the fog and the whole kind of, you know, the kind of grandeur of nature.
Yeah, and where does Central California? Yeah. Where does Central California, because there you could further split that into Central, which I would argue starts somewhere between Ventura and Santa Barbara and goes up to Point Conception.
Yeah, if you want to do a tripartite treatment, that's what happens. It's around Ventura, Santa Barbara, and then goes up to around Monterey.
That makes more sense.
Santa Cruz to me is where Northern California begins.
Right, because Paso Robles. And all those places, those are still considered, Central California. I was there a couple weeks ago. I was at Halama Beach. You know where that is?
Is that out where the sand dunes are?
It is south of there, I believe. Yeah, it's south of there. Yeah. It's little south of and over on the coast from Lompoc.
Uh-huh.
I was there to watch supposedly a satellite launch from Vandenberg, which was scrubbed twice because that campground is about 4 miles south of Vandenberg Air Force Base.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So I saw I went there and I did see a rocket launch from there. And it was a warm summer night with an offshore breeze. So it was absolutely crystal clear. 9 o'clock at night. It was so clear we could see the first stage falling off and still burning as it tumbled and fell into the ocean.
Wow. Yeah.
So that was it was dramatic. Anyway, we've digressed into a reverie about California, but
yeah, appropriately enough, I mean, that is largely the focus of my writing, is the history and culture through the development of spiritual groups here.
Right. How has it changed? I mean, what are the spiritual groups like now as opposed to then? And I'm not talking about I guess I am talking about ones that have survived because they've had to change. Do they address anything differently or?
Yeah. It depends on which one it is, and I will say there has been one of the demarcations I put out there is Jonestown, that many things changed after that. That California, unusual religions in California were not considered these kind of funny eccentricities anymore. That now you have the real pejorative and nasty connotations of cult coming out after that, and that was certainly. I mean, it was certainly contributed to by Charles Manson, but that was so much smaller scale and could at least be blamed on the 60s counterculture there. I mean, it came out during After People's Temple, what a fairly establishment character, at least in San Francisco, Jones had been. And so there became a fear after that of, oh, God, what's the next one going to be? How many of these nuts are out there trying, just manipulating and brainwashing people and bringing them into these weird sects to do God knows what. Certainly a lot of that was reinforced by Heaven's Gate,
right,
20 years later.
Yeah.
I think that's a big dividing line for me. After that, I think there was less creativity. I think there was just a much more suspicion about new spiritual groups here. Okay, what are they really all about? What's, is this going to lead to another 900 people taking poisonous Kool-Aid in the jungle and falling, dropping dead?
Yeah.
I would say that's part of the answer is there's definitely a then versus now situation created by that incident.
So what is now?
than what is now.
What's the difference
what
now?
Is,
well, are they a lot
now,
quieter, maybe?
What?
Are these groups a lot quieter? Is that the difference? Or
I think, yeah, I think a lot of them are more lower key. I think there is this consciousness at the same time, though, I think there's still quite a bit of activity out there in all sorts of forms. One of the, I think, as far as sheer numbers, the biggest group that I have dealt with in Califia's Children, or will be dealing with, is the Universal Life Church, which came out of Modesto.
They have
over 20 million people that they have ordained as ministers through the mail and now through the internet.
Yeah.
And so there you have just this dizzying diversity of groups and beliefs and things they're doing and reasons for existing and whatnot that was made possible by this, basically, it's a corporate organization that has the vaguest and most general statement of belief imaginable, and that can kind of keep under this very wide umbrella all sorts of organizations and beliefs and whatever, and still say, well, we're still the ULC. It's still, you know, with the local ministers, local chapters, so long as they stick within the law, can do what they want. And I think you still have a lot of that too. It's less visible, but the diversity is still pretty striking, and I'm always discovering new groups and new people out there and struggling to kind of incorporate them into my work and into the greater project.
Yeah, because they range from groups with thousands or maybe hundreds of thousands.
Or millions, like the ULC.
Down to groups with like four people in them.
Yeah.
I think you got one of them in there. That what was the homosexual church of the whatever?
Yeah. The incest and homosexual church of the universe. I don't want to go into them too much. I think I have kind of a lock on that subject on the internet because I know that Adam Parfrey wrote about them as well for the a weekly newspaper down in San Diego.
Oh yeah, it was the Reader. He wrote Hell A.
The piece was never preserved on the internet. Now I've got like the only thing, and there's a wacky little bunch there. They never got beyond. It sounds like never got beyond four people, and they've been defunct ever in the last in the years since their leader converted to Vietnamese Buddhism and then passed on at a very advanced age.
Great. I guess it was good that it would probably advance beyond like four people, at least right now in this country.
Yeah. That's another example of a really outre sort of designer group based on this guy's one vision that he'd been ahead of his time and being very pro-homosexual and very pro-gay. I said, okay, that now in the 1980s seems to be, you know, that this is now accepted as a normal thing among most people, and as they have powerful allies and whatnot. Okay, who's the next fringe group? Okay, well, what about people that have co-sanguine sex and relationships? We moved on to that, and I tell about that whole story in the post. The ministering to people who are living on the edges or have been rejected or are just beyond the pale. And that's certainly a big part of the history of both Christianity and Buddhism and why they prospered in their very different ways. And that dynamic certainly plays out with the various sects and new religions here as they tend to address themselves to groups that have been marginalized and give them a voice and give them a metaphysical rationale for their existence and for them keeping going.
Yeah, well, whatever works for people is... is what works. And as long as they're not, you know, and with a lot of these groups, as long as they're not hurting anybody else, forcing or maybe even more importantly, forcing anybody else in their belief system, that's probably the best you can do.
Yeah, I am. I am as close as anybody can come to a First Amendment absolutist about the freedom of religion, so long as you are not doing murder, rape, robbery, et cetera, anything that I think every civilization would consider a crime. Yeah, it's as legitimate as anything else. Go for it.
Yeah.
And I think that you would be protected under my understanding of the First Amendment, so long as it is not a openly or proven criminal enterprise.
Right.
It's just part of the great tapestry of America and the West and the whole human spiritual experience.
Right.
And certainly California.
Well, we are at 1 minute till 10. So,
well, thanks for having me on. This has been really, really interesting talking about this stuff. And,
well, I hope so.
You and your viewers have been properly informed and entertained.
Well, I hope so, Michael, because I read some of the stuff on the site. I read some, you know, a couple months ago, and then there were a few more today. And I hope what I was asking you, one, made some sense, and two, allowed us to talk in depth about some of this stuff. And, you know, I think it did so.
It's good getting that feedback from the listeners and those suggestions.
Yeah. What did you say? Well, there might be. Go to the Califia's Children blog site and check out some of this stuff and comment, read.
Yeah.
It's incredible stuff. I mean, I can't believe the information that Mike's been pulling up. Is some of this, how much of it is internet and how much of it is just in books and libraries and all that is just depends on the subject.
Well, it's my writings that are based on primary and secondary research, and they're just coming out onto the internet. And some of it I'm getting off the net, some of it I'm getting off of my rather voluminous personal collection of books and publications and notes and whatnot here.
Yeah.
I've been collecting this sort of stuff for almost 30 years. And have wanted to do this for many years, and have kind of had a few false starts. And now with califians.blogspot.com, I'm finally getting it out there and getting it, you know, getting an audience for it.
It is amazing stuff. I'm interested in this stuff too, and it's a treasure trove, really, of information about weird belief systems. And it's just something. I sat here for probably 2 hours and just read through stuff. And some of them are so detailed. You're just like, oh, that must be the end of it. And there's like another, you know, there's another like 2,000 words yet that you have to get through. And you're like, oh my, you know, I can't believe it. You know, it's one of those things where somebody, you know, have you ever got that in Weird California? People say, how did you find out this stuff? You get interested in anything, and you start finding stuff out. You just become obsessed, actually.
That's true. That's true. That's been my life since I was an adolescent, I think. Since I was a kid, I've just always been intrigued by odd, unusual, offbeat things. And I've got a couple books out doing that. Hopefully we'll be getting a third one out with this. In the meantime, you know, the writings are out there on califias.blogspot.com.
Oh, that's one more question I had. Have you gotten any positive or negative response to the site?
So far, a little bit of positive, no negative stuff. I mean, I think it just has not too many people are reading it right now. It's just kind of a hidden gem. But hopefully, after tonight, we'll pick up a few more people. And I want to hear what people have to say, positive, negative. Whatever, I'm open to criticism. I'm open to praise. more information, more writing out there. You know, correct me on things. Give me new leads. Whatever. I listen to it all.
It's just, there's nothing like it online anywhere, I don't think.
Well, thank you.
All right, Mike. Thanks so much. And next time you're in L.A., you damn well better make some time to say hi, because at least I want to have some coffee with you and say hi.
Yeah.
And talk to you about
my usual roaring through town. Yeah. Okay.
Talk to you about.
All right. Take care. Thanks a lot, Greg. Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot, Mike.
Okay. Bye.
See ya. Amazing stuff. Thank you so much, Mike Marinacci, for being on. I had some stuff. Oh, look, somebody messaged me on Facebook. Blech. No, they didn't. It's probably just a comment. Rocky Angel says, I especially like the parts about Christian Aventa and that one group from the 1920s. Comparisons to performance art and the odds are good, but the goods are odd. Liner genius, too. I'd like to see the hosts, Mike's writing about 1950s UFO contactees, too. Yes, Mike will have a very good and informed and interesting take on it, because he's not coming from the UFO wacko thing like I and people that are around the show are on. He's coming from a completely different sociological viewpoint and viewpoint of them as belief systems rather than being centered on the UFO thing. So, yeah, I can't wait until he has that stuff up too. What was I thinking of that I wanted to play? I'll read the thing for it because I would just like to. 1947, Alan Michael was sitting in his truck in Long Beach when he's beamed up via an, quote, ultraviolet light entwined with gold threads, unquote, where Space Brothers asked him to form a political party based on New Age principles. It was not until 1954 that Michael had another contact described at his website, which is still in existence. It was early one morning as the sun was rising. I was on my sun deck on top of my art studio in Long Beach, California. I looked up and a great round cloud was forming overhead. The telepathic voice in my consciousness told me to follow the cloud to the desert and I would greet my space comrades. He ended up at Giant Rock, site of the Interplanetary Spacecraft Conventions, which were hosted by George Van Tassel, which everybody listening to this knows. Alan Michael's One World Family Commune was formed in San Francisco in 1976, went into the studio to record music based on Michael's space age philosophy. Sound is a standout. Alan Michael riffs on the word in glorious echoplex, obviously delighted with the studio effects and what was being done with his voice. So let's listen to close out this wonderful show with, there's three comments now, with Michael Marinacci. Anyway, this is Sound from the album Quasar, One World Family by Alan Michael and the One World Family group from 1976. See if it works.
Sound. Sound is astonishing because it sounds in space. Where does it come from and where does it go? Time and illusion. Sound not related to the time it seems to take. I hear stars continuously playing their cosmic symphony, and great spaceships adding their drone around Placentia, planet of plenty. I am Michael. My words go forth to fulfill the things for which they are sent. And do not return to me void. Sound of spheres, sing, of life calling us forth to affirm the truth and to act in its eternal celebration. The sounding word can create joy for all of us, and the words of reaction playing back cause people to excel onward towards the light to comprehend it. Sound is shaped into music. I have run the cycle of it all and have returned to sound. 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 That sounds a warning, yet delivers. Can you make a sound? Try to make a sound that can go round the planet and from planet to planet, calling forth those who travel on instant, weightless, timeless, light beams of sound. 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 Sound.